time, you dress so fine, do the bumps of dime in your prime. Then you, people call, say beware doll, you're bound to fall, you thought they were all kidding you. You used to laugh about everybody that was hanging out. Now you don't talk so loud. Now you don't seem so proud about having to be scrounging your next meal. How does it feel? How does it feel to be without a home? Like a complete unknown, like a rogue. Lonely, but you know you only used to get juiced in it. Nobody's ever taught you how to live out on the street, and now you're gonna have to get used to it. You say you never compromise with a mystery tramp, but now you realize he's not selling any alibis as you stare into the vacuum of his eyes and say, do you want to make a deal? How does it feel? How does it feel to be on your own with no direction? And the clowns when they all did tricks for you. Never understood that it ain't no good. You shouldn't let other people get your kicks for you. You used to ride on a chrome horse with your diplomat, who carried on his shoulder a Siamese cat. Ain't it hard when you discover that he really wasn't where it's at, after he took from you everything he could steal? How does it feel? How does it feel to have you on your own with no direction home? Steeple and all the pretty people, they all drinking, thinking that they got it made, exchanging all precious gifts. But you better take your diamond ring, you better pawn it, babe. You used to be so amused at Napoleon in rags and the language that he used. Now he calls you, you can't refuse. When you ain't got nothing, you got nothing to lose. You're invisible now, you got no secrets to conceal. How does it feel? Ah, how does it feel? Yeah!
Thanks for listening to great speeches and interviews on Axis, Sacramento, and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just joining us, we're listening to Fighting Patient Mistreatment with Otis Brawley, Chief Medical Officer and Executive Vice President of the American Cancer Society. He talks with Lisa Alaferas, KQED Health Editor, about how messed up our medical system is.
He lived for almost 8 weeks, and in the end, he was in an intensive care unit. He had had numerous cardiac arrests and been resuscitated successfully, only to have more cardiac arrests. He had had a thalamic stroke and had lost control of his temperature. He was on a ventilator. He was septic and on levofed and dopamine. And one morning, I realized that this black kid from Detroit was sitting at the foot of the bed of this Slavic factory worker from Cleveland who probably didn't like the idea of a black guy being in the room. And I was about to tell the nurse what his vital signs should be that day. You see, since he had stroked out his thalamus, he was in a waterbed where we control the temperature. Since he had stroked out, or he had had an MI and had lost his AV node, we had an artificial pacer in his neck down into his heart, so I could set his heart rate. On the ventilator, I could set how much air he breathed in and how much he breathed per minute, or how many times he inhaled per minute. And then with the levofed and dopamine, if I dialed it to the right, his blood pressure went up. If I dialed it to the left, his blood pressure went down. This poor man existed in this state for almost 2 months, and then finally, several days after that, he mercifully had an arrest, and we could not bring him back. We spent probably $750,000 over 2 months on this poor man, and the nurses, the priest, the doctors, even other patients couldn't convince the family, let's just keep him comfortable. Unfortunately, Mr. Hujic is not the only time I've gone through that in my career. And then there was Ralph. Ralph was a guy who called me in 2003 because I'd been outspoken about prostate cancer. Ralph was a wonderful human being. He and I had a lot in common. He was a white guy from Indiana. I was a black guy from Detroit. It's still the Midwest. But Ralph had actually had a Jesuit education as well. Ralph and I used to tell Jesuit stories and compare them, and actually compare them to James Joyce's Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. It's a book where James Joyce criticized his own Jesuit education, and it's required reading in Jesuit high schools. Ralph had been forced to go to a local mall for prostate cancer screening by his wife. She had seen this advertisement from this hospital that they were having free prostate screening. He didn't want to go, but she forced him to go. And then he had an abnormal measurement, and he went to this doctor's office where he was referred to, and everybody in the waiting room had been screened at that same place. He didn't like that place, so he went someplace else. He went across town to this young guy who had this new Da Vinci robot, and his hospital was advertising him. He liked this guy, and he got the Da Vinci robotic prostatectomy for prostate cancer. He had 1 out of 12 biopsies positive, with 20% having Gleason 3+3. Disease. In my Forrest Gump life, and by the way, if you've ever read the book The Emperor of All Maladies, I do sort of think of myself as Forrest Gump, because about 3/4 of the people in that book I know personally. One of them is a guy named Don Gleason, who did the Gleason scoring for prostate cancer. He never wanted Gleason 3+3 prostate cancer to be called cancer. He called it adenosis. You see, Don used to say, people want to cut cancer out, so I want to call this adenosis. And unfortunately, the urologists, the surgeons, the treaters overruled this pathologist and called it cancer. Well, Ralph had this cancer. He got it cut out with the Da Vinci robot, and then his PSA didn't go down. Well, he's a smart guy, college educated. His prostate's in a bottle in somebody's lab, and he still has PSA in his blood. He must have cancer somewhere. So he starts freaking out. And he goes doctor shopping, and he finally finds a radiation oncologist who, for $80,000 billed to his insurance, gives him IMRT, basically radiation to the pelvis blindly. It's sort of a shotgun blast. Maybe we'll hit cancer there. Unfortunately, Ralph ends up with every side effect you can imagine. And when Ralph called me to talk to me about my feelings about prostate cancer screening, he had an ostomy on the left to collect stool and an ostomy on the right to collect urine because he had had a pelvic dissection. It was terrible. And Ralph and I talked about prostate cancer screening. He asked me why was I so outspoken about prostate screening, and I explained to him I had been an aide to David Satcher when he was Surgeon General. I got to go to the apology at Tuskegee, or the President Clinton's apology for the Tuskegee syphilis experiment at the White House. Now, the Tuskegee syphilis experiment was a period of about 40 years where the U.S. government lied to about 700 men. And 2 weeks after that, I was back at the National Cancer Institute, and I went to see a cancer center. When the guy from the NCI, the federal government agency that gives out millions of dollars, goes to a cancer center, they have this dog and pony show that they put on. Well, in the intermission, I happened to be sitting next to a marketing guy. That's when I realized that marketing people are evil. This marketing guy started talking about their prostate cancer screening program at the hospital. And you see, he could explain to me that if they announced that they were going to screen 1,000 men 6 weeks from now at a certain mall, he knew how much extra business they're going to get in their breast cancer clinic from mammography, because women would go there because that hospital cares so much about their men, they're taking their mammogram business there. He knew how much extra business they're going to get in their chest pain clinic. He knew how much extra publicity they were going to get for free. It would cost X if we went to NPR, but if we announced we're doing free prostate screening, we're going to get it for free. Once they got to the mall and they screened 1,000 guys who volunteer over the age of 50, their previous year's data for several years showed that 135 would have an abnormal screen and come to their hospital to figure out why it was abnormal. He even knew 10 additional would have an abnormal screen and would go to their competition. But they would get 135, charge an average of $3,000 to figure out why the PSA was abnormal. Of the 135, 45 would actually have prostate cancer. Of the 45 with prostate cancer, he knew the percentage that would get surgery, the percentage that would get radiation, the percentage that would get cryosurgery. That's another thing that we used to do with no data and stopped doing, by the way. He knew all this stuff. And then he tells me, you know, if we screen 1,000 guys and diagnose this 135 with an abnormal PSA and diagnose 45 with prostate cancer, this is the number of artificial sphincters we're going to sell, because this is the number of guys who are going to have incontinence to the point that diapers just don't hack it for them. And then he apologized to me. There's this new thing called Viagra on the market. That screwed up his estimate of how many penile implants he was going to sell for impotence. But he's talking to me. I'm an epidemiologist from the National Cancer Institute. I asked the money question. Well, it turns out it wasn't really the money question. I asked, if you screen 1,000 guys, how many lives will you save? He took his glasses off, looked at me like I was a fool, and he said, don't you know? There's never been a study to show this stuff saves lives. I can't give you an estimate on that. And it took me a second. You know, I'm from Detroit. I'm a little slow. It took me a second to realize this guy knows how many artificial sphincters he's going to sell if he screens 1,000 people. He knows how much money he's going to make if he screens 1,000 people. But he doesn't know if he's going to save a single life. It turns out that the data to show calculate how much harm is done from prostate cancer screening to this day is actually better than the data on how much good is done. As a matter of fact, I was looking at just recently recommending for informed decision making on the question of prostate screening within the physician-patient relationship, the American Cancer Society that I work for, the National Comprehensive Cancer Network, those are the cancer centers of the world, the American Society for Clinical Oncology, the European Urology Association, the American Urological Association, the surgeons. Recommending against routine screening are the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, the Canadian Task Force on the Periodic Health Exam, the American College of Preventive Medicine, and the American College of Physicians. By the way, the American Urological Association recommendation for screening, which I actually like a lot, says, given the uncertainty that PSA testing results in more benefit than harm, a thoughtful and broad approach to PSA screening is critical. Patients need to be informed of the risks and benefits of testing before it is undertaken. The risks of overdetection and overtreatment should be included in this discussion. That's what the American Urological Association says.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Despite that, there's all this free testing that's still being done at all of these hospitals. There's actually one group that has vans that have been purchased by Kimberly-Clark that goes around the various doctor groups and does free screening in supermarket parking lots. And in the summertime, they go around to state fairs. Why does Kimberly-Clark buy these vans? I don't know if prostate cancer screening saves lives, but it sure as hell sells adult diapers. Kimberly-Clark makes Depends undergarments. Lung cancer screening. There's been a prospective randomized trial of lung cancer screening that says that if you screen 27,000 people at high risk for lung cancer because they smoke more than 30 pack years, that's a pack per day for 30 years, you actually save 84 lives, but you cause instrumentation that kills 16. Now, that's science. We at the ACS recommend that people who have an extensive smoking history realize the double-edged sword of screening. Yes, it saved 84 people, but it caused 16 people to die of premature death. By the way, there were still 340 who died of lung cancer over 10 years. If you want to get screened, you should get screened. That's what we at the ACS says. St. Joseph's Hospital in Atlanta has ads right now recommending that non-smoking women in their 40s who have lived in an urban area for more than 10 years get screened because they say, according to St. Joseph's Hospital, they're at high risk for lung cancer. Their business plan actually involves the fact that 25% of all non-smokers will have a false positive exam, and your insurance will pay to figure out why that exam was false positive. You see, we have in this country a form of corruption in medicine, and actually we allow it all to happen. This corruption, who's at fault? It's the doctors, the hospitals, the insurance companies, the lawyers, the patients, patient advocacy groups. We all accept it. We all accept not being scientific, not being rational. We keep talking about rationing of health care in the United States. We need to be talking about rational use of health care. If we had been rational, bone marrow transplant would have only been available through a clinical trial in the 1980s and would never have been offered in the 1990s. I've come to realize when you're talking to doctors, it's difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on his not understanding it. That was Upton Sinclair, by the way. Let me bash a drug company real quick. Prilosec, great drug. AstraZeneca had one problem. 4 years left on the patent. They started this thing called Operation Sharkfin. Operation Sharkfin was to find a new drug. Well, it turns out they figured out, they had a chemist who had a law degree, and it turns out that Prilosec is really one drug, but it's a three-dimensional thing, so it's really two molecules. And we, in chemistry, they call them left and right-handed, just like your left hand and right hand are mirror images of each other. Well, it turns out the left-handed molecule suppresses acid. The right-handed molecule in Prilosec, your kidney does a wonderful thing. It urinates it away because it's inert. It doesn't do anything. What did they do? They created a new drug, happened to be the active ingredient in Prilosec, got a new 18-year patent. What did they call it? Nexium, the big purple pill, the marketing guys again. Prilosec is now a generic. Nexium is one of the 10 most prescribed drugs in the United States at $6 a pill, $180 a month. Generic Prilosec is available for 25 cents a pill, less than 10 bucks a month. Why is it that one of the 10 most prescribed drugs in the United States is on the market because AstraZeneca sent three studies to the FDA showing it is equivalent to Prilosec? Okay? This is how we get totally irrational and we start accepting this. It's really the greedy feeding the gluttonous. There are many people who want Nexium because it's the new drug, it must be better, not because the package insert says it's on the market because it's equivalent to Prilosec. You don't have to look far, folks. We need rational medicine. In the history of medicine, we've done so many things. Hysterectomy, C-section, carotid endarterectomy, bypass. We've overdone them. Erythropoietin. There's just numerous examples and numerous examples. Why is it that our healthcare bill is $2.6 trillion in 2010? $2.6 trillion is a lot of money, by the way. The entire gross domestic product of France, the sixth largest country in the world, is $2.55 trillion. 18 cents out of every dollar in the United States is spent on health care, and we are 49th in life expectancy. We are 44th in infant mortality. We are not getting what we pay for. We have the most expensive economy for health care in the world. And the last thing I'm going to say before I open it up to questions is the average cost of a health care plan for a family is $19,000 today. The American Cancer Society, we have a couple of thousand employees. We have people who get paid $25,000 a year in clerical work, but we end up paying $19,000 a year for their insurance. If you look at the number two country in the world for expenses, it's Switzerland, where the healthcare policy would cost $11,000 a year. There are a whole bunch of folks in the United States, companies with 60 and 80 employees that provide health care to their employees, who if health care costs were half what they are in the United States today, equivalent to the second most expensive country in the world, they would actually employ a few extra people. That 60 or 80 person company might employ three or four extra people if health insurance costs were less. You see, health insurance and overconsumption and gluttony, which exists in the United States and nowhere else, not in Canada, which is 10th in life expectancy, but in the United States, which is 49th in life expectancy, this gluttony is destroying the country. And it's simply being irrational and not following the science. You won't find Nexium being sold in Europe. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Brawley. He is professor of medicine at Emory University, chief medical officer and executive vice president at the American Cancer Society, and co-author of How We Do Harm, A Doctor Breaks Franks About Being Sick in America. I'm Lisa Alaferis, health editor at KQED, and now it's time for our audience question period. And Dr. Brawley, we've had several questions about what to do. We've had a question from the audience about, is Medicare the solution? A question from, if everything were reallocated, would we have enough money to serve everyone? What do we do?
If everything were reallocated and we reallocated it and did it in a rational way, we could actually save an awful lot of money, and we could have much better outcomes. I am not optimistic, however. You know, the thing that I didn't say is the gross domestic product in the United States is growing at a pace right now where by 2025, a quarter out of every dollar will be spent on health care, and by 2050, it'll be well over 50 cents out of every dollar spent on health care. That's growth that's not sustainable. So I do think we're going to have health care reform. I think we'll have health care reform when our economy collapses because of the weight of health care. Unfortunately, I do not think that we have enough courage to actually do the health care reform that we really need, which is really transforming how we view health care. And it's going to take everybody, the doctors, the lawyers, the patients, the hospitals, the insurance companies, everybody's got to buy into this. Let's practice medicine rationally. There are going to have to be some limits. There's already rationing going on in the United States. There will have to be some rationing. We're going to have to say no to some people. In terms of some treatments, we're going to have to say, if you want to stay in the hospital for two extra weeks after your hip replacement, you're going to have to pay for it out of your pocket. Your insurance won't pay for it.
We also have several questions related to how much can informed patients drive this. We have quite, there are a lot of, there's an e-patient movement, there's there are a lot of people who believe in market reforms, that if patients had more fiscal and more monetary involvement in having to make selections about treatments, how much can patients, can consumers by themselves do?
I think that if patients have some skin in the game, meaning they have to pay some out-of-pocket expenses, that they actually will be a little bit more conservative in how they actually consume health care. Not too long ago, I was at a pharmacy, and this lady was told by a pharmacist that the drug that she wanted, she could get over the counter for $12, but if she fill the prescription, it would cost her insurance company about $80. And she explained that she had a $10 copay, so she wanted to get the prescription. Never mind, it would cost her insurance the extra $70. I do believe that we're going to have, in many instances, certain types of rules about this is going to be treated in this way, and then ultimately we're going to stop, especially in cancer. There will have to be, unfortunately, I think, some rationing. There's going to have to be. I do think that patients need to be involved and need to be asking, is this right for me, especially if people had asked questions about bone marrow transplant, as opposed to just accepting what they heard about bone marrow transplant, maybe fewer women would have been transplanted and fewer women would have been harmed.
Franklin Delano Roosevelt's second inaugural address in 1937.
I see millions of families trying to live on income so meager that the pall of family disaster hangs over them day by day. I see millions whose daily lives in city and on farm continue under conditions labeled indecent by a so-called polite society half a century ago. I see millions denied education, recreation, and the opportunity to better the lot of themselves and their children. I see millions lacking the means to buy the products of farm and factory, and by their poverty, denying work and productiveness to many other millions. I see one-third of a nation ill-housed, ill-clad, ill-nourished.
More from Great Speeches and Interviews after these messages.